por existir.
Welcome to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. Today is Monday, November 19th. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Rohit Joseph. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Good evening. It is 5:05 p.m. and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from our UBC campus and from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. Also, on today's show, we'll be bringing you our international headlines from Democracy Now!
All this, plus your weekday weather forecast, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club, right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now for your UBC campus and local headlines.
The UBC Teaching Assistance Union, QP2272, voted this past weekend to ratify a four-year deal with the university. Passing with 82% of the vote, the deal covers the time period from 2010 to 2014. It includes 2% wage increases in its final 2 years and hiring preference for fifth-year doctoral students. According to QP2278 spokesperson Michael Stewart, quote, "It's been over 2 years of bargaining, so it's definitely a relief to have it done," end quote. Yet, some of the union's demands, such as cost of living protection, tuition waivers, or hiring preference for third-year master's students, were not incorporated into the deal. In response to the deal's shortcomings, Stewart said, quote, "This is not the deal we wanted," end quote. He went on to express his desire to look forward toward 2014 to resolve some of the deal's outstanding issues.
A UBC microbiology professor has won what is widely considered to be Canada's most prestigious award in Canadian pharmaceutical research and innovation. Professor Robert E. W. Hancock is being awarded the Prix Galien 2012 for his work examining the relation between antibiotics and bacteria. Simon Peacock, the head of the UBC Faculty of Science, said that, quote, "The Prix Galien is a testament to Bob Hancock's profound impact on Canadian health research. His research focuses on the growing challenge of antibiotic resistance and has resulted in new therapeutic approaches to infectious diseases like malaria," end quote. Professor Hancock has focused his research primarily on infectious diseases, founding the Center for Microbial Diseases and Immunity Research, and also co-founding the Center for Drug Research and Development, a national not-for-profit drug development and commercialization center. The Prix Galien was specifically awarded for Professor Hancock's discovery of a breakthrough way of modulating immunity, which, according to the prize selection committee, has the potential to revolutionize human healthcare.
UBC has implemented a permanent change to their admissions policy, which will now consider the grade 11 marks of BC secondary school students. The policy was originally an emergency measure made in response to the teacher strike last year. According to UBC Registrar James Ridge, the policy is being kept in place to provide UBC students earlier offers of admission. Quote, "Our research and certainly feedback that we get from applicants to UBC is that our offers of admission often arrive much later than our major competitors' offer of admission," said Ridge. "Part of the reason for that is that all of our major competitors make offers of admission factoring in grade 11 marks," end quote. Ridge also pointed out that research shows that grade 11 marks were almost equivalent to grade 12 marks in predicting the success of aspiring students. Richard Anstey, a member of the UBC Senate, said he had his initial doubts but has changed his mind. He says, quote, "I believe this will help us recruit the best and brightest. Many receive offers quite early, even in January, so we must aim to be competitive," end quote.
Vancouver's Fire and Rescue Services are rolling out a disaster training in early 2013 that would teach groups of citizen volunteers how to assist others in the event of a significant natural disaster, including an earthquake, also known as the Big One. Graduates of the 18-hour Neighborhood Emergency Assistance Team, NEAT for short, participating in this program will learn how to provide disaster first aid, use fire extinguishers and portable hydrants, learn the city's dedicated fire protection system, have basic communication and radio skills, and understand the incident command system. The program, which will be conducted at fire halls and community centers, will be taught by professional firefighters. Captain Ron Ewert with Vancouver Fire and Rescue Services Disaster and Emergency Planning Division said that once citizens ensure the safety of their families, they usually start helping others. but this can be very risky without proper training. He urged residents to educate themselves by attending workshops offered by the city's Neighborhood Emergency Preparedness Program. Information on sessions can be found online at vancouver.ca.
And those are your UBC campus and local headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but do stay tuned for your provincial and national news.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts downtown at
212 Productions, Beach Street Records, Blim, Dream Apparel, The Fall Tattooing, The Kiss Store, Heart and Soul Clothing Inc., Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Scratch Records, Vinyl Records, Woo Vintage Clothing, and Zoo Shop.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. We now have your local weather forecast for the week, brought to you by Environment Canada.
So for tonight, we have showers ending this evening and then cloudy with a 60% chance of showers, amounting to 5 millimeters. Windy early this evening with a low of 7. For Tuesday, rain amounts 10 to 20 millimeters. Winds becoming southeast, 30 to 50 kilometers an hour in the morning, gusting to 70 over exposed coastal sections in the morning and in the afternoon. Temperatures steady near 9. For Tuesday night, showers of 5 millimeters, windy evening in the evening. Temperature steady near 7. On Wednesday, rain, high 8. For Thursday, periods of rain, low 6, high 9. Friday, rain 7, high 9. Saturday, rain, low 6, high 10. And Sunday, cloudy with a 60% chance of showers, low 5, high 9. Currently, it is 8 degrees and cloudy. So it looks like a pretty rainy week ahead.
Thanks, Claire, for that depressing week. But anyways, that's Vancouver for you, folks. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9. It is now time for your provincial and national headlines.
Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper signaled on Monday that his government will treat state-owned enterprises differently than private sector companies when it decides whether to approve foreign investments in Canada. Ottawa is currently evaluating a $15.1 billion bid by China's state-owned CNOOC to take over Canadian oil producer Nexen Incorporated, as well as a $5.2 billion proposal by Malaysia's Petronas to buy Progress Resources Energy Corporation. Decisions are expected in the next few weeks. At about the same time as those announcements are made, the Conservative government plans to set out a broad policy framework on direct foreign investment, although it already introduced some guidelines for investments by state-owned enterprise in 2007. The guidelines refer to the market orientation and corporate governance of foreign buyers. In a question-and-answer session at the Canadian-American Business Council, Harper said, quote, "We created guidelines specifically for state-owned enterprises because, yes, state-owned enterprise represents a different kind of player, and obviously there are some of the issues that are before us today," end quote. The government is expected to decide on the two bids and lay out its new framework by December 10th, its deadline for deciding on the next in bid.
Two international aid agencies with experience building schools in countries such as Haiti and Honduras will be lending their expertise in Canada as they help to build a trade school for Aboriginal students in northwestern Ontario. Currently, 70% of students on First Nations students on reserves do not complete high school, and it is hoped that the building of this trade school near Thunder Bay will provide some incentives for students to work towards. Because federal funding for First Nations has been limited, Anishinaabe Aski Nation Deputy Grand Chief Gois Kagamik wanted to look for alternative sources of funding. He sought out a planning group of approximately 30 people to discuss the trade school with representatives from a bank, a municipal organization, the provincial government, mining companies, and the two international aid organizations, HopeLink International and Schools for Children of the World. Kakemek said, quote, "You see, the Federal Ministry of Aboriginal Affairs isn't here. We need to think outside the box," end quote. The group is hoping to see the school begin limited operations next fall.
BC Liberal caucus workers are being criticized for excessively digging into Liberal Party attack ads. Liberal caucus spokesman Ben James reminded caucus workers on Monday that their caucus duties do not include doing party work during their day jobs. James says a caucus-wide note was issued after emails surfaced indicating some members of the Liberal caucus helped to produce a Liberal Party website criticizing New Democrat leader Adrian Dix. The can'tafforddix.ca website was released by the Liberal Party in October 2011, calling Dix the architect of BC's economic decline during the 1990s and reminding voters that he quote-unquote fabricated a memo for NDP Premier Glenn Clark. NDP social development critic Carol James says the anti-Dix website and its creators reveal a government and a party out of ideas as it sputters towards a May election. Officials in Premier Christy Clark's office say they are not commenting on the creation and release of the website.
Nigeria has terminated a $24 million electricity contract with Canada's state-owned Manitoba Hydro. The presidency said on Wednesday, in a setback for plans to privatize a moribund power sector that is holding back economic growth. The hiring of Manitoba to manage the national power transmission network had been seen by industry experts as a major step forward for the reform process. The presidency said President Goodluck Jonathan annulled the deal because, quote, "due process was not followed in the award of the contract," end quote. But his decision could add to fears about political interference in the sector that analysts say are holding back badly needed foreign investment. Africa's most populous nation of more than 160 million holds the world's ninth largest gas reserves, but is blighted by power cuts, which last several hours a day, forcing businesses and individuals who can't afford them to rely on diesel generators. Economists say a successful power privatization could push growth in Africa's second largest economy into double digits from around 6.5% now. Manitoba was supposed to start work at the beginning of September, but transmission is still in control of the government. Sources within the privatization process said the Ministry of Power was unhappy handing over to Manitoba. Don Priestman, the head of the Manitoba-run Transmission Company of Nigeria, said, quote, "We had a clear contract, and we were meant to be given delegation of authority, but that didn't happen. There are forces working against reform," end quote. He added that a similar contract that Manitoba has in Kenya was working well.
Those were your provincial and national headlines for today. We now go to Free Speech Radio News for a documentary on Canada's missing and murdered Indigenous women.
A November 22nd, 2012. Today, we bring you a special Thanksgiving Day documentary, Silenced Sisters, Canada's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. Please stay with us. In Canada, violence against women disproportionately affects Indigenous communities. Official statistics indicate around 600 Indigenous women and girls have been murdered or have gone missing over the last 3 decades. Many of their families have been searching for their loved ones for years. They've also launched initiatives to help stop the violence. Yet despite vigils, campaigns, and repeated calls for action, many say the government's response has been slow and inadequate. Programs that were created to address the problem have been cut and important resources reduced. Family members and loved ones describe a long struggle marked with pain and grief. But they continue to organize and demand justice. From Ottawa, FSRN's Tanya Castle brings you some of their stories.
This is Carrie Ann Stone and Taisha Jones. They were the two murders. They got a serial killer on Vancouver Island.
Gladys Raddick knows the story of each woman pictured on her white van, or as she likes to call it, her war pony. Dozens of 8x11-inch photos are taped with bright pink and purple duct tape to the side and rear doors of her vehicle, so that everywhere Raddick drives, she will bring attention to Canada's missing and murdered Indigenous women.
So I change up the pictures every once in a while because, as you know, this violence is escalating in Canada, so I have to switch them up every once in a while. All of it is done by donation. Even if I ask somebody for a roll of tape, somebody will bring me over 2 rolls of duct tape. And I write on the duct tape frame, missing or unsolved. So basically, it doesn't matter where I drive, anywhere in this country, people are going to ask questions. Are all these people missing or murdered?
For decades, Canada has experienced high levels of violence against Indigenous women. The Native Women's Association of Canada, or NWAC, estimates approximately 600 women have been murdered or gone missing in the last 30 years. However, the issue has received little mainstream attention and concrete long-term prevention efforts by government. Victims' families are doing much of the work when it comes to drumming up public awareness and pushing institutions to tackle the issue. But their efforts are often met with disinterest, budget cuts, and an apparent lack of political will. Raddick's family became active around the issue when her niece, Tamara Chipman, disappeared in 2005. Chipman was 22 years old at the time and last seen along the Highway of Tears, or Highway 16, in northern British Columbia. Over the past 40 years, advocates say that more than 30 women, mostly Indigenous, have gone missing or been found murdered near the highway.
When Tamara went missing, I met up with another activist friend. Her name is Bernie Williams. That's when she suggested that we should compile a list and start talking to family members. So that's what I did. And I went online and I started talking to family members through Facebook. The power of the internet is just crazy. And, you know, even though I'm still not technical savvy, that's where I got the majority of my information. Plus, I had the opportunity to meet with other family members, and so I started compiling my list.
Since 2005, Raddick has compiled a list of missing and murdered Indigenous women, far exceeding NWAC's at more than 3,000. And in the process, she's met others with missing relatives, people like Michelle Pinault, who lost her daughter, Stephanie Lane, in British Columbia.
My daughter disappeared in January of 1997. She was 20 years old. Her DNA was found in 2003 on Robert Picton's farm. So in all those years, we never knew where she was. And then we found out that she had been murdered.
Robert Picton was the culprit in Canada's largest serial killer investigation. His victims were all women, some of them sex workers, and the majority of them Indigenous. Although he faced more than 20 first-degree murder charges, Picton was convicted of 6 second-degree murders of women from Vancouver's downtown east side. In 2007, he was sentenced to 6 concurrent life sentences with no eligibility for parole for 25 years. Pinot says she didn't know Aboriginal women and girls were going missing and being murdered beyond her home city of Vancouver at such an alarming rate until she began her work with RADC and to connect with other families.
I feel strongly. As a mother of a daughter who was murdered, I didn't even know the enormity of the problem. And I feel if I didn't know as a mother, how do other people know? And so that is what I now try to do. I've just started Gladys RADC, who is a wonderful activist for murdered and missing women. She kind of took me under her wing, and I call myself, she said, my little activist one day, and I said, I'm not an activist. And she said, oh, yeah, you are. So I call myself an activist in training. Because I really, you know, but I think it's very important that people know just how enormous this problem is.
Sisters in Spirit, the NWAC initiative that tracked the deaths and disappearances of Aboriginal women and girls until it was shut down in 2010, documented 153 murders between 2000 and 2008. This represents approximately 10% of the total number of female homicides in Canada, whereas Indigenous women make up only 3% of the country's total female population. Standing at the side of the road, Bridget Tolley points to the location where her mother was struck and killed by a Quebec Provincial Police cruiser on the highway running through the Kitigan-Zibi Reserve in October 2001.
This is where my sister lives over here, and my mother lives right across the road. That's where she lived. That was her house. And the night she got killed, she was there. She was having a few beers there with my sister. And she was crossing the road here. And if we just walk up a little bit over here, I'm sure she came by the driveway. And that night, and the police said that she was almost, you see where the yellow lines are? She was in the middle of the road there. And there was 2 police officers that were on the car. And they said that they didn't see her. One of them said she thought she was a sign, and the other one thought she was a dog.
Tolley describes the investigation into her mother's death as flawed from the start. The report was done by Quebec Provincial Police, the force involved in the death, instead of by Reserve Police, and no witness statements were taken. Tolley says the police officer driving the cruiser was never administered a breathalyzer examination and was not charged with any crime.
I was looking for support. My lawyer told me in 2004, he said, either I quit right now He said, or I have to go get support from the national organizations. So I said, well, I can't quit. I mean, I'm just starting, you know. And that's when I went. I went to meet the Native Women's Association of Canada, and Bev Jacobs was their president. So I asked to meet with them, and they let me meet with them and the lawyer for NWAC. And I showed them my case, and I told them what they wanted. So they started supporting me, and I went to the Native Women's of Quebec. Then I came to the Quebec Chiefs and the Algonquin Chiefs and my reserve and the AFN and Amnesty. So that's when it all started. And then I met Bev, and she introduced me to the families of Sisters in Spirit because it was just starting in 2005. I met her in 2004. And they invited me to the family gathering they had for the Sisters in Spirit. So I thought that was great. Every family was talking about, you know, it was like a family. And then this is when I thought it was great to have the support and, you know, to help me fight for an independent investigation. So it was nice, and I stayed with them for till the money ran out.
During this time, she also launched an annual vigil to draw attention to the case of her mother and all of the cases of missing and murdered Aboriginal women across Canada.
And in 2006, I asked NWAC and Amnesty to help me start a vigil to honor my mother, because I was trying to find a way to bring her inside Parliament, you know, to one of the MPs. And I couldn't do that. I didn't know anybody and stuff, and I was just starting. So I said, well, at least I can bring her outside to the steps of Parliament. And after meeting at the other families, I knew they were not only forgetting about my mom, but they were trying to forget about all the missing women. So I asked them to help me, and this is how the first Sisters in Spirit Vigil got started, was in honor of my mom and all the missing and murdered women.
You're listening to Silenced Sisters, Canada's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, a special Thanksgiving Day documentary from FSRN. Please stay with us.
Singing and drumming opened this year's vigil on Parliament Hill on October 4th, where more than 300 supporters looked on as 20 families held pictures of their missing and murdered mothers, sisters, daughters, nieces, and cousins. It was one of approximately 160 vigils held across Canada. The need for vigils is as great as ever, says Tolley, who estimates that at least 200 Aboriginal women and girls have gone missing or been murdered since the closure of Sisters in Spirit's database in March 2010. Lita Lorraine Blacksmith, who traveled to Ottawa from Manitoba, held a picture of her daughter, Lorna, reported missing in January of 2012. Her body was found 6 months later. She was 18 years old. With tears streaming down her face, she listened to a man sing a traditional Ojibwe song for the loss of his sister. Blacksmith's killer, Sean Cameron Lamb, was charged with 3 counts of second-degree murder in connection with her death and the deaths of 2 other Indigenous women in Winnipeg. Hours away and years before, Lori Ojik's daughter, Maisie, went missing with her friend Shannon Alexander on September 5, 2008, in Maniwaki, Quebec. She was 16 years old.
We miss Maisie every day. But the next few months that are coming are even harder. Maisie loves birthdays, Christmas. She's always the one that come and decorate our home. Get her siblings ready. She loved to do those things, you know. I would just give her money and she would go to town kind of thing. And it's not the same without her. And every year on their Christmas list, they just ask Santa to bring their sister home. They don't ask for toys. They just want her home. We can't give them that. And we live through that every year and every day. And it's hard. We've learned to live, to move on. But there's still that hole. There's still that hole for her, and that we miss her. But we've, as a family, we've learned to live. And that's the hardest part. And that's what takes courage. Is to live without knowing what happened.
Ojik spoke at this year's vigil just as she has for years, but she's not optimistic there will be significant government action.
And the vigils on Parliament Hill, I honestly believe, I hate to say that half the time, I feel like we're blowing smoke out of our you-know-whats. But we're there to fight for our girls, and we're always going to be there fighting. But I don't think we'll ever be heard.
In the March 2010 budget, $10 million was pledged over 5 years to address, quote, the disturbingly high number of missing and murdered Aboriginal women by taking concrete actions so that law enforcement and the justice system meet the needs of Aboriginal women and their families. Critics say most of the $10 million went toward police initiatives that are not specific to Indigenous communities, and little went to Aboriginal women-led initiatives. The same year, NWAC's operating budget was significantly reduced and the Sisters in Spirit initiative cut. Nikki Ashton is a member of the New Democratic Party, the largest opposition party in Canada. She critiques the work of the government on women's issues for her party.
It's totally inadequate. First of all, the organization that did phenomenal work in this area, Sisters in Spirit, was cut. Then subsequent commitments, both in terms of the RCMP and in general, have never referenced Aboriginal women specifically. And the reality is that the face of this tragedy is the face of an Aboriginal woman. It's impossible to generalize any more than that. And if the current federal government in Canada is truly committed to making a difference, then it would recognize that it's Aboriginal women who we're talking about, and that that's who we have to work with to understand what's going on.
When contacted for comment, the RCMP declined to go on record about the cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women. Information available on the RCMP website lists effort to work with local police forces and its support for the creation of a National Center for Missing Persons and Unidentified Remains. Human rights organizations are also calling for more resources for nationwide programs geared at stopping the violence against Indigenous women. Alex Neave is the Secretary General of Amnesty International Canada.
For years, Indigenous women themselves and groups and national associations working with them, Amnesty International, have made it very clear that what we need is a concrete, well-coordinated, comprehensive national action plan to address this violence and bring it to an end. Is that too much to ask? One would assume it's a very simple and obvious request, but year after year, the government refuses to do so. They do a little bit here and a little bit there, fund an initiative, make an announcement, but they don't take the kind of coordinated action that is necessary to truly bring this crisis to an end.
According to Statistics Canada, a government agency, Indigenous women are 5 to 7 times more likely than other women to die from violence. Despite the $10 million allocation for this issue, Ashton says there's been little examination of the root causes.
On all levels, I mean, the indicators are most extreme for Aboriginal women in Canada. Life expectancy compared to other women, access to economic opportunities, access to safe housing, access to education. And in some ways, you know, Aboriginal women have done tremendous work to break the barriers. But the reality is that the barriers that exist are deeply rooted and systemic. And unless those barriers are addressed, and of course in Canada, the federal government has a key role to play in working with Aboriginal people more than any level of government, to be able to get rid of the barriers and certainly be a willing partner rather than an obstruction. It's necessary to see the federal government take on and commit to putting an end to frankly, the in many cases, the third world living conditions Aboriginal women face.
Aboriginal women experience higher levels of poverty and unemployment, lower levels of education, and a lack of housing in comparison to their non-Aboriginal counterparts. Across Canada, more than a third of Aboriginal women live in poverty, with the rate of unemployment double that of non-Aboriginal women. Indigenous women who do have jobs often work in low-paying occupations in the sales and service industries. According to NWAC, these restricted options push Indigenous women and girls into risk situations or coping strategies, which, quote, increase their vulnerability to violence, such as hitchhiking, addictions, homelessness, prostitution, and other sex trade work, gang involvement, or abusive relationships. While there are no nationally collected statistics regarding Indigenous women in the sex trade, research indicates that the number of Aboriginal women involved in prostitution is disproportionately high, particularly in the prairie and western provinces. NWAC data shows in at least 51 cases, victims were known to be involved in prostitution at the time of disappearance or death. Pino says the discrimination against Indigenous women and sex trade workers is one of the reasons why the disappearances of women from Vancouver's marginalized downtown east side continued for so many years.
When it comes to trying to find them, we're not given the same as, like in Vancouver, for instance, with the Picton, it has been said over and over, if these were white women, that they would have been out looking for them in droves, and that is true. And they just, they really dropped the ball when it came to these women, and Picton should have been caught years earlier than he was caught. There was a lot of women that were murdered because they just didn't seem to care.
As early as 1998, the Vancouver Police and RCMP were conducting separate but related investigations into the missing women from Vancouver's downtown east side and the possible connection of Robert Picton. He was eventually arrested in 2002. Since then, both police forces apologized to families for the mistakes made in the investigation. They've also released a report that offers recommendations for future investigations, such as increased cooperation between the forces. Justice for Girls, an advocacy organization for teenage girls who live in poverty, reported in 2005 that Aboriginal girls are targeted by violent men because of their vulnerability, and in particular because police and courts are less likely to respond to reports of violence against them. In October 2011, the United Nations Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women declared it would launch an inquiry into the disappearances and deaths of Aboriginal women after receiving a request to do so by NWAC and the Canadian Feminist Alliance for International Action. The request argued the Canadian government was not adequately addressing the violation of rights of Indigenous women. The inquiry has not yet started. Dwight Dorey is the National Vice Chief of the Congress of Aboriginal Peoples. He is not optimistic about Canada's response to this issue.
Well, the sad reality is they tend to ignore it. And as has been stated here, if it wasn't an Aboriginal problem, if it was just a woman's problem in general, it wouldn't be acceptable, in our opinion, by the Canadian public nor by the Canadian government. So why is it acceptable, or I shouldn't say acceptable, but tolerating, tolerable, because it's Aboriginal women? Are they of less value? I mean, that's the problem with it, and that's what the message seems to be. You know, our people are not that important to call an inquiry into the problem.
In July 2012, First Nations chiefs from across Canada first called on the Canadian government to establish a national public commission of inquiry to investigate Canada's missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. This month, chiefs and all 13 provinces and territories, ministers of justice, Aboriginal affairs, and status of women met in Winnipeg to discuss the workings of a national inquiry and propose a national action plan to address the high levels of violence against Aboriginal women. The federal government did not participate in the meeting and has not given any indication it will conduct an inquiry. Gladys Raddick, in her War Pony van, recently drove 2,500 miles to move from Vancouver to Canada's capital, Ottawa, to join TOLI and other Indigenous organizations in their fight for justice for missing and murdered Aboriginal women.
I just thought I'd be closer to fight them here, and just living closer. And, you know, I hope to get a job, somewhere in the field where I can help people. And, you know, I want to fight for resources for these women's organizations and shelters. I know what it's like to live the poor life. I have nothing, but I don't need anything. All I need is to be a voice for those families who have asked me to represent them.
One of the women she'll be speaking for is Michelle Pinault, who says she's never recovered from the loss of her daughter, but over the years, she's built up the strength to fight against the loss of other women and girls.
The grief is always there. The grief is always as strong as it always was. I think you just become a little bit stronger through the whole process, but the grief never, ever goes away. But then when you start getting into this, trying to raise awareness, of course, then it's out there every day, and you have to be strong and enabled in order to do that. And for years, I couldn't, because it was just too painful. It's too painful. The pain, it's got to be brought out. So even though it hurts, I say if I can help save a life, then my daughter's death will not be in vain.
Thank you.
Join Free Speech Radio News on Friday, November 23rd, for a special program, Rising Tides, Rising Voices, Climate Change and the New Reality.
And those emissions are destroying the planet, and you see it in China, and you see it in El Salvador, and you see it in Peru, and now you see it in New York.
We're beginning to see some opening up in terms of disclosure about what
I'm
is really
Abram
going on,
with
about
FSRN how much resources have been taken,
how much
violence
been
in Gaza continues unabated today. At least 100 people are dead after 6 days of airstrikes and rocket fire, with dozens of young children among the dead. Efforts to broker a ceasefire and prevent a ground invasion in Gaza are ongoing in Cairo, where Israeli officials are meeting with Egyptian peace negotiators who are talking to Hamas representatives. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon arrived today to participate in the talks, and a peace delegation will travel to Gaza tomorrow. We'll have much more from Gaza later in the newscast. Stay tuned. Afghan President Hamid Karzai ordered his staff to take full control of the American-built Parwan detention facility at Bagram Air Base today. President Karzai says the U.S. has reneged on commitments under a deal signed last March to transfer control of the prison to the Afghan government. Karzai said that Afghan courts have cleared dozens of men detained at the prison, but the U.S. won't free them. And U.S. troops continue to retain control over hundreds of recent detainees in what Karzai calls a serious breach of their agreement. More than 1,000 Kurdish prisoners on hunger strike in Turkey broke their fast over the weekend, and Turkey says it will open direct talks with the outlawed PKK militant group. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports.
On Saturday, jailed PKK leader Abdullah Öcalan called on the hunger strikers to end their action. Many were immediately hospitalized after 68 days of subsisting on water, vitamins, and sugar. The strikers had been demanding an end to solitary confinement of their leader and the right to defend themselves in court using their native tongue. Turkey's Justice Ministry announced today the government will resume talks with the PKK as deadly clashes between militants and the military continue almost daily. Hugh Pope of the International Crisis Group in Istanbul says past precedent shows direct talks are effective at stemming violence.
The last time that this happened, when there was a serious period of negotiations, the number of people getting killed in southeast Turkey dropped by half. And that's something we really need, because in the last year and a half in southeastern Turkey, we've had more than 860 people killed.
More than 40,000 have been killed since the early 1980s in a conflict over language rights and political autonomy for Turkey's ethnic Kurds. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
President Barack Obama arrived in Phnom Penh today for meetings with leaders from the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN. He immediately met with Cambodia's Prime Minister Hun Sen, who defended his human rights record. Yesterday, ASEAN leaders agreed to consider human rights in light of regional and national contexts. Hun Sen defended his record similarly, saying Cambodia has a unique set of circumstances. On his way east, President Obama stopped in Thailand and Burma, also known as Myanmar. Ron Corbin reports.
In a speech at the Yangon University Monday, President Obama threw his support behind the reforms of the past year under President Thein Sein. Mr. Obama pressed for national reconciliation, especially in strife-torn Western Arakan State, where rights groups say up to 200,000 people are in need of relief. The violence has pitted Buddhists against Muslim Rohingya, stateless under decades-old laws.
Every human being within these borders is a part of your nation's story, and you should embrace that. That's not a source of weakness, that's a source of strength.
But opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi, who met Mr. Obama at her University Avenue residence, warned against the mirage of success in the country. Myanmar's military remains powerful, controlling parliament and capable of blocking constitutional reform. Earlier, Myanmar authorities released 51 political prisoners. U.S. officials have highlighted reforms, ranging from release of political prisoners to press and media reforms, new labor laws, and a new foreign investment law. But the U.S. is calling on Myanmar to carry out deeper reforms, with economic sanctions, while eased, still lingering. For FSRN, this is Ron Corbin in Bangkok.
Unrest continued in a suburb of Nairobi today after an attack on a minibus yesterday killed 9 people. John Bokali is in Nairobi.
9 people were killed Sunday when an explosive device was thrown into a public minibus. At least 34 were injured. A suspect was arrested soon after and is of Somali origin. ethnic violence then broke out with attacks against Kenyans of Somali origin in the neighborhood known as Little Mogadishu. The area member of parliament immediately called for the clashes to stop.
Demonizing and stigmatizing and attacking a particular community is not going to resolve our problems. We need to work together. We need Christians and Muslim leaders to come together to condemn this act, to work together for peace of our community.
Shops remain closed today and riot police use tear gas to quell angry crowds. The BBC reports that hundreds were arrested. Two other grenade attacks in recent months attributed to Al-Shabaab have fueled communal tension in the area. John Bokali, FSRN, Nairobi.
For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abraham.
After 6 days of bombardment on Gaza by the Israeli military, Gaza's health ministry warns it is running out of medical supplies. Since the start of the military campaign, many of Gaza's 1.6 million residents have been forced to stay inside their homes, and only emergency vehicles and those delivering food or supplies are allowed movement under the siege. Armed groups in Gaza fired more than 100 rockets into southern Israel today, though Israeli police reported no casualties, according to Reuters. Yesterday and today, the Israeli army fired missiles into buildings in Gaza City that house local and international news agencies. On both days, it attacked Al-Sharuq, where Palestinian agencies, Britain's Sky News, and Saudi-owned Al-Arabiya channel have offices. Israeli government spokespeople say the military was targeting Islamic Jihad fighters who were in the building. FSRN's Rami Al-Maghari has more from Gaza.
Earlier today, the Israeli military bombed the Sharuq Media Tower in Gaza City. At least one person was killed in the attack. Ramiz Harb, a senior commander in the Islamic Jihad's armed wing. Three other people were injured. The building housed both local and international media agencies. The blast set fire to the lower levels of the building, trapping journalists working on the higher floors. Firefighters worked to pull them out of the blaze. Today's attack follows two other media building bombings in Gaza City on Sunday. Eight journalists who were working in their offices were injured. One of the wounded, Khader al-Zahar, who works for Beirut-based Al-Quds TV, had to have his right leg amputated. He is now in Egypt receiving medical care. Another journalist, Hussein Al-Madhoun, was working with Al-Zahar in the Shawa and Husseri building when the missile blast hit the building and wounded Khader al-Zahar on Sunday.
Myself and my colleague Darwish Balbol heard the explosion and we rushed right away to aid our other colleagues in the living room to find them under rubble and bleeding. While we were aiding them and pulling them out of the rubble, one more rocket hit the building.
Meanwhile, Gaza's health ministry is warning that they face a shortage of surgical supplies needed for operations and intensive care units at Gaza hospitals. Dr. Ashraf Al-Kidra is a spokesperson for the health ministry in Gaza.
We urgently need medicines and equipment used in surgical operations for our emergency rooms, including anesthetics and painkillers.
Al-Qidra says that they launched an emergency appeal to Arab health ministries and World Health Organization. Most Gaza residents have been confined to their homes since the Israeli airstrikes began 6 days ago. Houses, car, motorcycles and media buildings have been destroyed by bomb blasts. Movement is extremely limited. FSRN visited one Gaza family in the southeastern Gaza city of Al Zaytun while Israeli airstrikes are ongoing. Mohammed Dalul is a 25-year-old university graduate. He was holed up in his home with his mother and older brother.
The shelling is so continuous that I thought their F-16 aircraft must have a timer that is set to automatically fire a rocket every quarter of an hour. My aunt, along with her children, moved from the Tal al-Hawa neighborhood in western Gaza City to our home here. With their presence, our stress and worry have doubled, since many children have been harmed so far. We are worried about these children more than we are worried about ourselves.
When the Israeli air strikes on Gaza began last Wednesday, Naima Dalul, Mohammed's aunt, and her seven kids moved in downstairs. She sleeps with the children in one room, hoping it is safer than other parts of the house. Her husband is traveling abroad.
Actually, I have a bad state of mind at the moment because their father is not present. Meanwhile, I try to give them comfort and support them by saying, just don't worry. God is there, and you can see there are people in the street.
More than 100 people have been killed in Israeli airstrikes in Gaza since the Israeli army fired a missile on a Hamas military leader last Wednesday. Three Israelis have been killed by a Palestinian rocket attack on their home during the same time period. Rami Al-Mighari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
Thank you to FSRN for those stories and headlines. For more from FSRN, check out their website at fsrn.org.
All right, and that's our program for today, Monday, November 19th. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more on independent news, join us on Mondays and Fridays at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Rohit Joseph.
And I'm Claire Eagle. Today's show is produced by Iqbal Ahmed. From the entire news team here at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Sore Throats Clapping Hands right here on CITR 101.